and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is September 15th, 2025, and this is episode 549. I am the co-host Mark Ames in Western New York. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe, please, at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd. And I'm on the line with the War Nerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher. Back home, right?
Back home in Puglia.
Finally. Yeah.
Yeah, those things that used to be called pocket rockets, those high-revving street bikes, they never stopped during the long weekends. But to me now, they feel like home. So I'm fine with them.
Right. So we recorded a great interview with Mohsen Milani. He wrote a very useful book that we'd like to get out there called Iran's Rise and Rivalry with the United States. And we're going to be posting it as a two-part interview. So this will be part one, which will go back in history, as he does in his book, to the old imperial past, because when you read his book, you'll see certain consistencies and thought processes in Iranian foreign policy, and which also informed their relationship with the U.S. And then we'll post part two shortly afterwards. But before we get to our interview with Mohsen, probably should discuss some of the big news of the day. I mean, the last episode we recorded shortly after right-wing influencer Charlie Kirk was assassinated. And in that episode, we had, without wanting to make a prediction, we had a kind of guess that it would be somebody with confused politics, as they tend to have these days. And right now, we're getting confused pictures of the assassin. Of the reputed assassin. Anyway,
nobody Tyler can get Robinson. Their story straight.
Yeah.
I mean, across the board.
It's, he comes clearly from a classic Utah white Mormon Republican family, gun nuts. I mean, you probably saw the photos of him as a kid, firing all kinds of guns, including, I think, a 50 caliber. So he was somebody who knew guns very well.
I mean, to be fair, he shot pretty well.
Yes. Yeah.
One shot.
Yeah. People were saying he must be a pro. And I think, as we talked about last time, he doesn't have to be a pro. He just has to be somebody who has experience firing hunting rifles. And he definitely had that. And from what we know, Tyler Robinson, he started off at the university there. He got a pretty good scholarship at UVU. I think it was at UVU. And he dropped out. He was a straight-A student in high school and apparently did very well in his ACT. And wanted to live near his parents, wanted to stay nearby, and dropped out after a semester. And
I
then
mean, yeah,
went to a trade
look,
school.
You can tell a lot from the photos. Look, this is our culture. We know these people in our bones in some way. Mm. And compare the would-be Trump assassin, compare his photos with the photos of Tyler. There's a very clear gap there. The Trump assassin was someone who was going to be bullied all through school, probably had a fairly wretched home experience, and looked like, a perfect breeding ground inside that skull for revenge, just general revenge.
Yeah.
Tyler looks like somebody who might have been socially successful, but wasn't happy about something.
And so one theory, they're trying to say he's a left winger, that in that one semester at noted hotbed of Marxism, Utah Valley University, that in that one semester in 2021, which was done mostly through Zoom, he was turned into a Marxist or something. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody, well, I was saying nobody's serious, but people with power are pushing that. And so that power is serious. Unfortunately, that's...
Yeah, I find it a silly theory. But yeah. I do have to say, I remember a movie called Salt Lake City Punks or something like that. Mm. And the one good thing about places like SLC and Vegas, and if people don't know, I spent an academic year teaching in UNLV, if you could call it that. Hmm. Countercultures get pretty fierce there. It's not like the Bay Area where, oh, you're this or you're that. Like, oh, that's interesting. It's like you usually have to push hard to establish yourself in some counterculture.
No, that's a really good point. I wanted to say that too. I mean, I spent some time when I worked for Not Safe for Work with, you know, the editor, great editor, Paul Carr. I spent some time in Salt Lake City, and that's exactly what Salt Lake City was. Now, I don't know about, I don't think it's the case with Orrin or wherever UVU is, although it's a college campus, so it would have some counterculture, but I don't think he didn't live on the campus. Right. So I'm not really sure how that worked, but as far as I know, he didn't live on the campus. But Salt Lake City was definitely an island, even though it's the headquarters of the Mormon Church, an island of real counterculture. It's a great city. I thought it was a lot of great people there. And very liberal, like liberal not in a smug sense, but more, as you said, in a kind of fierce sense, like we're surrounded on all sides and this is our fort, you know.
Yeah.
and they have their places and their culture. It's pretty cool. I like Salt Lake City a lot. I know a lot of people have spent time there who do. And one thing I've definitely noticed, having known a lot of Mormons who I really liked a lot, and then lapsed Mormons, as they call it, or ex-Mormons, is that gay ex-Mormons or anti-Mormons, but gays who are, you know, raised in Mormon households, really had it rough. Yeah. The Mormon, like Mormons are, we've talked about in the show, I've had really good experiences growing up and throughout my life with Mormons, practicing Mormons and not. And, you know, we talked about that on one of our earlier episodes, and some listeners pointed out, they said, well, yeah, you say that, but if you're gay and in the Mormon world, it is not nice at all.
No.
It's deadly.
No.
Yeah.
Partly because I think there's a very elaborate, intense theory in that religion,
yes,
of marriage and obviously heterosexual marriage. Mm-hmm. And it's meant to last forever. It's meant to be a deep bond. And this either sort of works or goes very, very wrong. And when it goes very, very wrong, bad things tend to happen.
Well, it's based around having children and the children, yeah, peopling your planet, whatever, you know, your world, whatever it is. Yeah, it's very much around that. And so homosexuality is, I mean, you're really oppressed if you're gay and you have to massively repress it. And so that can create, you know, other angers. And so there is that there that's being pushed by the governor. And I don't know if it's true or not, because it's still too early. But the New York Times did report it as something being said for so far, that he may have had a partner who is transitioning. This would be, now if it's true, I mean, I'll tell you what makes me skeptical is how badly the right wanted it to be trans.
Yes.
I mean, so badly. And the governor himself, who doesn't seem like a dyed-in-the-wall MAGA type, seems this kind of goofy Republican, but he was on TV saying when they first found out, when they first had the photos of this guy, Tyler Robinson, and who his parents were, he said, and gosh, we're so upset because we really didn't want it to, we were hoping it wasn't one of us. We were hoping it was one of them. We were hoping it was not somebody from this state. Like, it was basically really clear that he, but the pressure coming from, you know, Trump world and Kash Patel's people and so on was find the trans link here, you know?
Yeah.
And God, and it may turn out to be true. I don't know. But they're going to pay. And it's, I mean, everybody who had nothing to do with it is going to pay. And so it's going to be awful. A lot of people are going to pay for a while.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, the good thing is, we can try to track it because we don't have any big backers. Well, they could just turn off our show, I suppose, at the source. But short of
they
that,
could put Barry Weiss. They could put Barry Weiss in charge of Patreon, and I would not discount that possibility. Or Matt Walsh in charge of Patreon.
Well, they could co-host the show. That would be great.
Man, it's going to be, I have a feeling like the lust for cancel culture revenge is so strong, and it's not going to go away in a couple. People think, it'll go away in a couple of days. It will not. They've been gearing up for this for years.
I saw a video of a white middle-aged guy.
Yes.
In tears, sort of screaming. And in tears.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole genre of people doing TikTok video, middle-aged males in the front seat of their car, the driver's seat, filming themselves screaming and yelling into the camera and posting it.
Yeah. I assume most of this was faked. It seems much more embarrassing if it's real. Well, I'll just stop there.
It is real. And man, I just took a walk this morning in the Erie Canal, and there was a guy wearing I can't remember what it said, but it was a Charlie Kirk t-shirt. It was clearly brand new, spanking new. He was like kind of middle-aged dad age guy walking around talking about, I think he was a landlord, and he was talking to his tenant or a manager. And I do think it's real, and I think it has to do with, I mean, people who follow Charlie Kirk we're obviously be personally enraged in that way. But I just think there's a lot of ambient, absolute rage. And it's finally got its excuse to work off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the old song says, you'll always know your neighbor, you'll always know your pal, if you've ever navigated on the Erie Canal.
Was there anything else you want to say before we get to our interview with Mohsen?
No, okay. let's get back to more cheerful subjects.
Yeah, definitely. Let's remove ourselves from this shitty little world. Okay, good. Let's go straight to our interview with Mohsen Malani. We'll also be posting links, of course, to his book, Iran's Rise and Rivalry with the United States. Why do I keep sounding like Barbara Walters when I say rivalry? Rivalry.
There's something difficult about the RL.
Yeah, it's rise and rivalry, you know. But anyway, all right, let's get to our interview with Mohsen Malani. Okay, we are very excited to have with us our guest today, Professor Mohsen Malani. He's the author of the book that we're going to be discussing. It's called Iran's Rise and Rivalry with the United States. It was just published in February. Mohsen is an internationally renowned scholar of modern Iran. He's a professor of politics at the University of South Florida. He's published many works in academic and popular journals. He's had research fellowships at Harvard, Oxford, and also in Italy. We have John's in Italy. John's in the Puglia region of Italy, but you were in Venice.
Right.
And this is one of my favorite parts of your, or more kind of optimistic parts. You have provided expert testimony before the U.S. Congress on Iranian affairs, because I was going to say in introducing your book that, and we don't, I can't say I've ever, or I've rarely maybe said this before. We go through a lot of books on our show, but this is a book I would hope that policy people, pundits who pundit on Iran, and anybody else who's interested in it, but particularly in like sort of policy, academia, journalism world, really should read to get a better grasp. People who consider themselves experts should read this book. So anyway, first of all, Mohsen, thank you for coming on Radio Warner.
Thank you very much for your kind and generous introduction. And it is a great honor to be on your program.
Well, thanks. I mean, I want to get the word out. We would like to get the word out about your book because I just almost by accident came across your name, I think, on social media. I try not to go on social media much, limit it. Don't want to be driven crazy. But this was one of those times when social media actually did a good because it was through some thread, through somebody I was following, that I was introduced to your book. And I read it, and it's just, it's a very clear, unsentimental, and as kind of... trying to not take any sides, but just give sort of a factual and intelligent analysis to everything involving, Iranian history, even going back to, the Safavids and before, but also in order to place everything in context today between Iran and the U.S. and Iran and the U.S. and its allies in the region. And it's just very clear. Clear-headed, clearly written, and I really appreciate that. So let's start. I think mm-hmm. I feel like we should pretty much kind of follow the outline of your book when we talked about how what we would discuss today. I really think the way your book is outlined clarifies in a kind of step-by-step way so many things, and we'll have to get at the end that. But you publish the book publishing business is such that you put the book to bed, but it doesn't get released for close to another year after it's already put to bed. So a lot of things have changed even in the years since you probably finished writing your book. So we'll get to that later. But first, let's start with some background here. And I think one of your early really important points is an important point, which is that the Iranian sort of political psyche of sort of the ruling class or the governing class and others has a kind of memory of past greatness that will always influence how they see the world today. In a way, kind of like China, kind of like Russia. I mean, there are a lot of things here that remind me a bit of Russia, which is something I know much better. Could you talk a bit about Iranian history and its kind of great imperial past up through the Safavids and then, of course, the Qajar Empire when it starts to really go downhill fast.
Again, thank you for very kind words about my book. But before I answer your question, let me just make two points. I've been teaching for over now... 3 decades. And one thing I have learned in teaching is that if you want to be effective as a teacher, as somebody who wants to educate, you should try to be as objective as neutral as you can be. Mm-hmm. And let people decide rather than pushing your line, just state the facts, and your readers usually are very smart and they can draw their own conclusion. And that's what I try to do in that book. Secondly, I, as an avid reader of books and as somebody who loves great writers, including Hemingway, who is, for me, one of the most incredible writers of all time, you have to be able to write in a clear, concise language so people don't have to read your sentences twice mm-hmm. and still don't understand what the hell you're saying. In other words, I think a convoluted writing is not a sign of a great mind. It's a sign of a confused mind. And you have to be as clear in your writing as you can. Now, going back to your question, yes, Iran is one, I think, of the oldest surviving civilizations today. If you look at the index of the Old Testament and the New Testament, and look at the names of the countries or civilizations that are mentioned in those two holy books, soon you will realize that overwhelming majority of them no longer exist. And yet the word Persia and Persian Empire does still exist. There is remarkable continuity in Iranian history, which really started about 3,500 years ago in what is now known as Iraq and Iran and that part of Asia. But the beginning of Iranian history in many ways can go back to the time of the Achaemenid period, when Cyrus the Great established the largest empire the world had known. At least 26 of the present countries in the Middle East were once part of the mighty Persian Empire. And Cyrus was a great king. And there is a reason why they call him Cyrus the Great. Because in the Old Testament, we learn that he is referred to as a benighted Persian king who liberated the Jews from captivity by Babylonians and allowed the Jews to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple. The Achaemenids were extremely influential, especially the founder, Cyrus. I think your listeners might find it interesting that the American founding fathers, including Jefferson, were most interested in learning about Cyrus the Great. And they read the book. In fact, I read somewhere that Thomas Jefferson had two copies of the book that a Greek historian had written about the education of Cyrus the Great. And Jefferson really admired the way Cyrus the Great ran his empire, because one thing they didn't do was to impose their religion on the people they had conquered. That's why they were willing to allow the Jews to go back. They freed them from their captivity and allowed them to go and practice their religion. But the second interesting thing about the Achaemenid Empire, that they were extremely tolerant of religious and cultural and linguistic freedom. They allowed people to practice whatever they wanted to do. Anyhow, the Achaemenid ruled for over 200 years, and then Persia was conquered by Alexander the Great. And after he died, shortly after he conquered Iran or Persia, his generals ruled Iran for about 100 years, but they were not able to impose their culture on Iran. And then we had, after about another 400 years, when a great Persian empire ruled, finally we had the Sasani empire, which again was one of the largest in the world, and they were in constant war with Rome, with the Roman Empire, and then later on with the Byzantine Empire. And finally, as the Romans, Byzantine and the Persians were fighting against one another in what I call in my book, endless wars, they did not pay attention to what was taking place in 6th and 7th century in the Arabian Peninsula, where a young man, the age of 40, by the name of Muhammad, became prophet. And then we see the beginning of Rise of Islam. And ironically, even if Muhammad and his army, or the Islamic army, were by far less sophisticated than the Persians and the Byzantines, they were able to defeat both of them. And there, right there, is the beginning of a new chapter in Iranian history, the Islamic aspect of Iranian history. And that has continued until today. Now, around 500 years ago, after many decades of internal turmoil, internal instability, division, etc., Iran was, Persia was unified again. And a 14-year-old guy by the name of Shah Ismaili Safavi, he unified Persia, but he did something very unique, and that is he imposed Shiism as the state religion. Mm-hmm. Now, Shiism is a branch of Islam. Today in the world, we have about somewhere between 17 to 20% of Islamic world belong to this sect. And Iran is predominantly Shia, about 85 to 90%, maybe a little bit less of Shia. And there is only one other country that is Shia majority, and that is the Republic of Azerbaijan. Now, there are other countries where there is substantial Shia population and Shia majority, including Iraq and Lebanon, Bahrain, perhaps Qatar, and a few other countries. And since then, Shiism has become part of Persian culture and part of Iranian nationalism. And finally, let me make one important point about Iran. Iranians made huge contribution to world history, both in pre-Islamic and post-Islamic period. Pre-Islamic, the creation of this vast empire, and the way they managed their empire was a huge contribution. And there were a lot of other things in terms of military invention, in terms of developing postal services for the first time in world history, and a whole bunch of other things. Mm-hmm. And even after Iran was conquered and became Islamic, there is one thing that your audience needs to know about Iran, which makes Iran in many ways unique. Iran, unlike overwhelming majority of the countries that were conquered by the Islamic army or were Islamicized, Iran was never Arabicized. Iran accepted, embraced Islamic religion gradually, but kept its own cultural uniqueness and its own linguistic integrity. For example, Egypt, which is the inheritor of one of the best and most incredible civilizations in the world, when they converted to Islam, they were Arabicized as well as Islamicized. Today, they speak Arabic. That's not the case about Iran. And also, many of the cultural attributes or cultural rituals of Iran that goes back to the pre-Islamic time is still practiced in Iran. And that shows why Iran is one of the oldest surviving civilizations. So today what you have, and that's the summary of everything I have said, you're talking about a country that really has two interrelated but somewhat distinct political culture, a political culture that goes back to the pre-Islamic period and a political culture that Iran has inherited after it embraced Islam and in 1500 Shia Islam. Mm-hmm.
This raises so many questions, yes, that I've always wondered about. Like, I remember Bernard Lewis saying that Iran revived as a culture after a couple of centuries of silence or something, and that it adopted its own version of Islam. Do you think the patterns of resistance that are often, and, you know, I'm sort of an English major, so I hear a lot of this, are often expressed in poetic terms, were really a form of dissidence, like the poetry about wine and so on? Was that a form of resistance?
Excellent question. I'm quite familiar with the writing of Bernard Lewis, who was one of the great scholars of the Ottoman Empire. Of course, he knew quite a bit about Iran, but Iran was not his cup of tea, if you will. But the point that he makes about two centuries of silence, which is, by the way, the name of a Persian book written by a prominent Iranian history, which essentially Bernard Lewis, I think, saw an English translation of probably a book or a summary of it, and he used that. But essentially what the book says is that when the Arabs invaded Iran, Iran had a somewhat more superior culture. Not so much because Iranians are superior to the Arabs, it's because the Islamic, the Arab side was not as urbanized.
Right.
Arabian Peninsula wasn't as urbanized as Iran. And Iran had, when they had the rise of Islam, at least 1,500 years of knowing how to run an empire. And if you look at the evolution of Islam after the death of Prophet Muhammad, the first empire ruled for about 100 years, and it ruled from Damascus, which was at the heart of the Byzantine Empire. But then, with the help of some Iranian warriors, that mm-hmm. empire was defeated, and the capital of the Islamic world was moved to Baghdad, the capital of Iraq. In fact, the city of Baghdad was built by one of the first leaders of the new empire. Now, that new empire, called the Abbasid Empire, inherited quite a bit from the Persians, the way they governed, the way they ran their court, and a whole bunch of other things. Iranians played a major role. Now, there is something called the Golden Age of Islam, which is from around 800 to 1150 to 1200. And during that Golden Age of Islam, when Europe was going through its dark ages, we had Iranian scientists, Iranian philosophers, mathematicians, etc., etc., coming to Baghdad and contributing to the Golden Age of Islam. I just want to mention one or two because I think your audience would find it fascinating. Yes. The word algebra comes from somebody, Khwarizmi, and this is a sort of a Latinized version of his name. He is the one who introduced to the world at that time algebra. And most importantly, even more importantly than that, he is the one who popularized Arab Indian numerals, which is a complete set of numerals, unlike Latin numerals that right. does not have zero, that does not have negative numbers, that does not have fractions. Al-Khwarizmi introduced that, and in many ways, modern science owes a great deal to this great Persian scientists that work under the leadership of the Abbasid Empire. And there were many other Iranians who contributed to this. Now, inside Iran, if you move to the heartland of Iran, there was quite a bit of resistance, partly resistance against the Arab invasion, but more importantly, there was cultural resistance. And in Iranian history, in the post-Islamic history, there is one name that stands out. He is the icon of Iranian nationalism. He is accredited for protecting Iranian national identity. He was a fantastic poet, and his poetry is absolutely fantastic. They say that Shakespeare is the Western version of Ferdowsi. He came out with the book of Shahnameh, the Book of Kings, which talks about pre-Islamic history of Iran, often in very abstract ways. And he is the one who protected Persian language. And everything that came after him, I think, is a footnote to the writing of this great man. Now, during from say 1250, when the Mongols invaded Iran and conquered Iran, until 1500, even in that period, we had a good number of Iranians who came out with beautiful books of poetry, logic, etc. part of it was resistance, and part of it was because Iran was humiliated. One thing you can say about Iranian history is that it has gone through ups and downs in more ways than any country I know of. And if you look at the history of Iran, Iran has been conquered by Alexander. It has been conquered by the Arabs. It was conquered by the Mongols. And most recently, it was manipulated and somewhat controlled by Russia and the British. And yet, there is an entity called Persia. There is a country called Persia, and its history is connected to 2,500 years ago. Not too many other countries can make that claim. So yes, and the reason why there is that continuity, because there is resistance. Iranians cherish their sovereignty. Iranians cherish their uniqueness. Iranians think that they have contributed enough to world history that they deserve to be respected for who they are, so that they can live in peace and harmony in a very, very dangerous region of the world.
I'm old enough to remember when the Shah fell, and I remember that part of his last set of policies was reviving the look of ancient Persia and the statuary of ancient Persia, and yet it seemed to just enrage the average Iranian. Why was that?
Before I answer that excellent question, please allow me to say a few words about the background so that we can understand that celebration of 2,500 years of Persian monarchy in a proper context. In order to understand what is taking place in Iran today, its revolution and its anti-Americanism, I think we need to go back to U.S.-Iran relations after World War II. In World War II, like in World War I, Iran declared neutrality. And like World War I, in World War II, great powers ignored Iranian declaration of neutrality, and they invaded Iran. In World War II, the British, the Russians, the Soviets, and then the Americans together, three of them, invaded Iran in violation of Iranian sovereignty. The excuse was that we need Iran as a bridge to provide logistical support to the Soviet Union. They also, especially the British and the Russians, were very concerned about Reza Shah, the founder of the Pahlavi dynasty, who staged a coup in 1921 with the British help. And then 5 years later, in 1925-26, he overthrew the Qajar dynasty and established the Pahlavi dynasty. Now, the British and the Russians were very concerned right around the time of the start of the World War II, because Iran had developed close relationship with Germany, with Adolf Hitler's government. And they were over at least 2,000 or 3,000 German advisors living in Iran and helping the Iranian government at the invitation of the Iranian government. And the British and the Russians used that excuse, arguing that Reza Shah has pro-German sympathies, and therefore they asked him to step down. He did, and then they exiled him to South Africa, where Reza Shah, who was a true Iranian patriot and somebody who really built modern Iran, he was a dictator, no doubt about it, but he was a visionary dictator, and he did a lot for his country. But in exile, he died in grief, and then his son, Muhammad Reza Shah, the last king of Iran, ascended to the peacock throne.
This is now, the Shah that we all know as the Shah.
That is, yeah. that is the yeah. Shah that all of yeah. us know as the Shah of yeah. Iran.
Mm.
And he took over when he was 21 years of age. He really didn't know much about politics. But for a period from 1941 all the way to 1953, I would say that 10 years, that 12 years, should be called the golden age of democracy in Iran. We had different political parties. We had the formation of different political parties, from communists to nationalists, etc. The Iranian parliament had, relatively speaking, free elections. And the Shah of Iran did not govern. He did not rule. He was the symbol of the Iranian state. Mm. Which is what the 1905 Iranian constitution demanded. But by the end of the 1940s, something incredible happened in Iran, whose understanding is essential to knowing the dynamics of modern Iran. And that is a old man, I think he was in his late 60s, early 70s, French educated, got his PhD from a French university, and a Qajar aristocrat who owned a lot of land, was a very honest man by the name of Mohammad Mossadegh. He came along and said that we need to nationalize Iranian oil industry, which was really totally controlled by the British. Mm-hmm. And remember now, this is still, England is one of the, if not the, but one of the most powerful countries in the world. And their investment, this is absolutely fascinating. Their investment, the company that the British had established in Iran after they discovered oil in 1907. By 1951, when Mossadegh nationalized that company, it was England's largest foreign investment, period. Mm. Not wow. in the Middle East, in the world. Mm. And then that company eventually became known as something that all of you know about, the British Petroleum.
Now, or BP, as it's called.
Or BP, yeah.
Yes. So next time when you get any kind of gas from BP, remember the Persians and remember Mossadegh.
Yeah.
Now, Mossadegh's argument was that as long as we allow the British to control our oil, they can also control our government. They can also control our politics. He said that as long as they control our politics, we cannot have democracy. We cannot have a representative government, nor can we have sovereignty. By nationalizing Iranian oil, he said, we can regain our sovereignty, we can march toward democracy, and most importantly, we can have free, competitive parliamentary elections in Iran. Well, the British didn't like that. At the time, at the beginning, President Truman was in power in Washington. He had some degree of sympathy toward Mossadegh, even if a lot of people around him were accusing Mossadegh of being communist. He was no communist. He was not even pro-communist, but he had allowed the Communist Party, called the Tudeh Party, to operate, relatively speaking, freely in Iran. He was sympathetic to Mossadegh. Mossadegh went to Washington, tried to obtain a loan. He couldn't. But still, President Truman came out with a good idea, good suggestion, that if we, being America, we would support Iranian nationalization effort if the British are compensated. Now, Mossadegh, one of the things that I personally find a little bit problematic about Mossadegh, although I admired the man for what he did, he was a little bit too stubborn for my taste and too uncompromising. But he rejected the idea. And a few years later, the destiny of Iran and perhaps the destiny of the United States changed when President Eisenhower became president. Now, Eisenhower was a military man, and he had a military view of the world. And we are right now going through the heydays of the Cold War. Winston Churchill, who was prime minister at the time, and who had a personal dislike of Mossadegh, and he hated what Mossadegh had done to the British Empire, undermining the largest investment they had. He tried to persuade the president that we need to overthrow Mossadegh. Just a footnote, nowadays we hear about other countries trying to persuade President Trump or persuaded President Trump to attack Iran. End of footnote. But he, Churchill, was able to convince Eisenhower to attack, to agree with a coup d'etat. And therefore, in a joint operation called Operation Ajax, the British MI6 and the American CIA succeeded in overthrowing the democratic government of Dr. Mossadegh, and they restored the peacock throne for the young Mohammad Reza Shah. And immediately after that, the nature of U.S.-Iran relationship changed. Until the coup d'etat of 1953, Iranians in general, I would say vast thought of the Iranian population, praised America because they looked at America not as a colonial power. They thought that America is a natural ally of Iran, that America, because of its history, does not have a colonialist mindset and that has no territorial ambition over Iran. And I have to tell you, based on everything that I have read, I've talked to a lot of people who were alive in the 1940s, they all tell me that America was truly very popular in Iran at that time, unlike the British and the Russians who had had imperial ambitions in Iran. So after the coup of 1953, the nature of the relationship between many segments of Iranian population and the United States changed because they saw America blatantly intervening in the internal affairs of their country and undermining Iranian national sovereignty. And during the Cold War, from 1953, when the Shah returned to power, until 1979, the United States became Iran's closest strategic ally. Just two pieces of information would suffice to inform your audience how close that relationship was. Iranian Savak, or secret police, was built with the direct help of the CIA and Israeli Mossad in 1957. By 1979, when the revolution happened in Iran, there were over 50,000 Americans, let me repeat again, 50,000 Americans living in Iran, doing various business ventures and providing military advice to the Iranian government. And Iran was the number one, a buyer of American weapons. From 1971 to 1979, in that 8 years, 25% of all military sales of the United States was done by the Shah of Iran. 25% of every military sale was done by Iran. Yes. And this brings me to the question of the events in the mid-1970s called the celebration of 2,500 years of Persian monarchy. At that time, Iran was going through rapid economic development because in the late 1960s and early 1970s, under the leadership of the Shah and Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, oil exporting countries, had almost quadrupled the price of oil. And Iran was going through a period of incredible economic growth. But at the same time, there was massive opposition to the Shah's rule. And that massive opposition, as you know, crystallized into the Islamic Revolution only 4 years, 5 years later on. Yes, there was economic development, but there was opposition. And here is my answer to the mystery of the Islamic Revolution, Iranian Revolution. That is, why was it? How was it possible for the Shah's regime that controlled a notorious secret police, that had control over 550,000 armed men, that had, with the exception of Israel, had the best air force in the region. Its army was most equipped, and economically, Iran was doing absolutely fantastic. How was it that Iran then had a revolution and overthrew the monarchy? Well, the short answer to that is that if you look at the history of the Pahlavi regime, the father and the son, they did a great deal for Iran economically and socially and culturally. There is no question that what they did was much, much better, much, much more progressive than anything the previous dynasty had done in Iran in 100 years. So I give them a lot of credit for that. They built universities, they modernized Iranian state, they modernized the judiciary, they did a lot. And they sent hundreds of thousands of students abroad. I can't say enough good things about what they did economically, socially, and culturally. That said, the problem was that politically, the government or the state remained archaic, despotic, and unrepresentative of the aspiration of the Iranians. And therefore, there was this clash between economic development on the one hand and lack of political development or lack of political participation on the other hand. So there was a lot of opposition to the Shah. That opposition came from some Islamicists or Islamic activists. It came from radical leftists, Maoists, and a Marxist-Leninist organization, and from nationalists, those who inherited the legacy of Dr. Mossadegh, and they were upset. They were still upset about the coup of 1953. So all of these guys saw an opportunity when the Shah celebrated the 2500 years. They attacked him for spending Iranian money for useless adventures. Now, remember, when I said 25% of all U.S. military sales went to Iran, there were a lot of Iranians. In retrospect, I have to be fair, they were wrong. But there were a lot of Iranians at that time that criticized the Shah for plundering Iranian for Iranian money and treasure. And they were saying that these weapons that Iran is buying from the United States is making Iran ever more dependent on the United States and is turning Iran almost into a colony of the United States. There was that mindset. Therefore, all of these forces saw an opportunity for them to use that celebration, which was absolutely incredible. I urge your listeners to Google it and see the video of the kind of luxury that you would see at Persepolis. They used that opportunity.
Very extravagant, right?
They had chefs coming from Paris, pastries coming from France. I mean, all kinds of, frankly, useless stuff. And that angered a lot of Iranians. And this is the period also that the Shah, now with a lot of money for the first time, with a lot of petrodollars, with a strong military, with the total support of the United States, and some degree of support for the Russians, we see the Shah becoming much more dictatorial and much more autocratic than before. In right around a few years before the revolution, suddenly, without any warning, the Shah wakes up one day and says, well, it's time to put an end to the two parties that were operating. Now, keep in mind, these two parties were pro-Shah parties. Mm. That we used to say one of them was Yes Party and the other one was Yes Sir Party. They were both pro-government, but the Shah didn't like that. He couldn't tolerate even that much division. Mm. So he came up with the idea of one party, and he essentially announced on television that if you cannot and if you do not want to join that one party, we would be very happy to give you your passport and get the hell out of Iran. So you see that kind of drive toward a greater degree of autocracy, mm-hmm. partly because, again, of oil wealth and partly because the Shah felt so good,
right,
that he thought that he can make it possible for a smooth transition of power from himself to his son. Around that time, the Shah is diagnosed with cancer. And he knew about it probably, or maybe he had sensed it. I don't know whether he knew about it, but I think he knew that there is something wrong. But he was also concerned about the transition to his son. And that's, I think he wanted to make sure that there is unity of purpose, that there is unity within the governing elite so that he can have a smooth transition of power to his son. But none of that happened. And an right. old man in his 70s by the name of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini became the leader of a multi-class, national, broad coalition and overthrew the Shah in what I think is one of the most stunning and one of the most fascinating episode of the 20th century.
Absolutely.
And just one year before the Shah was overthrown, 1 year. I was at that time a student studying in California, and I remember I would watch the late Walter Cronkite on CBS News every day, Monday through Friday at 6:30. And I remember one day, it was, I think, New Year's Eve, when I saw the photo of President Jimmy Carter, and he was a great man, God bless him, going to the palace, Shah's palace in Tehran, and making this incredible statement, turning to the Shah, and I'm using verbatim, telling the Shah, thank you, Your Majesty, for having created an island of stability in one yes. of the more troubled regions of the yeah. world. And 53 weeks later, yeah. that entire system collapsed and Iran entered into its Islamic revolution phase.
Mm. Yeah, the first Islamist revolution then, and it just took everybody by absolute surprise. No one took the Islamists seriously. Everything, the future was supposed to be, if there were revolutionaries, left-wing revolutions. And yeah, we've talked about on the show many times about how 1979 was such a pivotal year where a lot of things changed in a big way. And of course, the Iranian Revolution was one big part of that. I wanted to say just two things real quickly. One is, I'm really glad you brought up this point about how central Iran was as a U.S. ally. As you quoted, the Americans considered Iran, the Shah's Iran in the 70s, as the policeman of the Persian Gulf, as one academic would call it, as America's sub-imperial power. And I think, you know, I've heard it argued that Iran's fall in 1979 had a lot to do with Israel's, this kind of bizarre elevation of Israel to, I don't know, some kind of super status, that they were, you know, they had been important, of course, to the U.S. before then. But with Iran gone, Israel became, you know, I think as Biden said, America's aircraft carrier in the Middle East. But before that, Iran was considered in many ways sort of on par in terms of importance with Israel, Iran and Israel. And the U.S. lost that. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that, but what I did want to ask you about is Lebanon and Hezbollah. And the reason I want to ask you that is because I didn't realize your story on the rise of Hezbollah, which really goes back, the rise of Hezbollah and Shiism, the interconnectedness between the Lebanese Shia community and Iran's Shia clerics and Islamists. I mean, it goes back hundreds of years, but in particular in the 20th century, there is this figure, Musa Sadr. So I don't know, could you talk about how, because everyone's trying to understand the relationship between Iran and Hezbollah, Iran and Yemen, and it's just passed off as a proxy, like as if it's created, you know, and it's just so, it's such a poor understanding of these relationships. So if we could talk about Hezbollah, because it's very mixed up with the Iranian Revolution.
I'll be more than happy to, but let me start by saying just a few words about Israel and the revolution in Iran. Mm-hmm. Iran was part of a UN commission in 1947-48 that was mandated by the United Nations to come out with a plan for Palestine, or for what it used to be called Palestine. Iran was one of the three countries that opposed what eventually became a UN plan to partition Palestine into two parts, Israeli and Arab part. Iran actually, with two other countries, they wanted to create a federated system with two components, the Arab components and the Islamic components. But nobody bought that. But immediately after the creation of a state of Israel, Turkey was the first Islamic country to recognize state of Israel. Iran was second, but its recognition was de facto. Officially, legally speaking, Israel did not have an embassy, did not have an ambassador, but for all practical purposes, Iran and Israel developed extremely close relationship. And as I said earlier, Mossad, the Israeli intelligence, played an important role in creation of Iranian secret police. Mm-hmm. The Shah had some disagreements with Israel, especially in the 1970s. But these disagreements, which basically was over Israel's approach toward the Arab countries, especially after the 1973 war between Israel and Egypt and its partners, there were disagreements about Iran's support for the Kurds in Iraq at that time, because there was a sort of a coalition of the CIA, Iranian Sabak, and Israeli Mossad to help the Kurds in Iraq to undermine Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. But after supporting that the Kurds, by 1975, the Shah suddenly, without any consultation with Israelis and very little consultation with the Americans, he decided to sign the 1975 Algiers Agreement, and the Israelis didn't like that.
Can you explain what that agreement was really briefly?
The agreement was that, yes, that the agreement, Iran and Iraq had been fighting over sovereignty, over Shatt al-Arab, or Arban Rout, which is the river that both Iran and Iraq use to go to the Persian Gulf for shipping purposes. Iraq claimed total sovereignty, and Iran said we have to have divided sovereignty, and that had been a source of friction between the two countries ever since Iraq was created as a independent country. It was created in 1921, but being really independent was around 1932. The Shah of Iran and Saddam Hussein had disagreement over that. And this is the time that Iran was becoming the policeman of the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. And the only country that was challenging Iranian hegemony in the Persian Gulf was Iraq. So the Shah at that time in 1973 saw a great opportunity to undermine Saddam Hussein, undermine Iraq, establish his status as the policeman of the Persian Gulf by supporting the Kurds inside Iraq. So they started supporting Mr. Barzani, Mullah Barzani, the one of the greatest leaders of the Iraqi Kurds. Iran started providing military support, technical support, and financial support. And the Israelis were on board. At first, Americans were reluctant to join because they wanted to make sure that Iraq does not move even further toward the Soviet orbit. Mm-hmm. But as a result of the Shah's lobbying effort, finally Richard Nixon, who was a close friend and confidant of the Shah, Shah was able to convince Nixon, and Nixon agreed that the CIA should get involved. So the CIA and Sabah and Mossad intensified their support for Barzani and the Iraqi Kurds, and they were able to really inflict heavy damage casualties on Iraq. But by 1975, the Shah decided enough is enough. And it is very important to point out the reason why he decided to end the conflict. He told the American ambassador in Iran at that time that he was afraid if he goes further than what he has, because Iran had troops inside Iraq, he was afraid that if Iran continues supporting the Kurds, there could be a full-blown war. He didn't want that. He didn't want that. Although the Israelis looked at that very different. For the Israelis, as long as Iraq was preoccupied in its internal business and could not focus on Israel, that was fine. Mm. Now, for Iran, Iran had different national interests. And that's why I think the Algiers Agreement was one of the greatest achievement, foreign policy achievement of Mohammad Reza Shah. Mm. He did the right thing because his decision to sign an agreement with Saddam Hussein to put an end to hostilities between the two countries, in which Saddam Hussein finally agreed with divided sovereignty over Shatt al-Arab. But the Israelis didn't like that. But the point, going back to the point about the Israelis, I think it is a mistake to think that the Israelis instigated the revolution or played a role in overthrowing Shah. Yeah. There is no evidence that they did this.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I didn't even mean to imply that if I did. I just meant that Israel became, because the U.S. lost Iran, I mean, first of all, because Israel had played such an important role in helping create and train Savak, that informed Khomeini and the Islamists' hatred, kind of, you know, ideological hatred of Israel, which goes on today, and the nationalist anger at Israel, but also that because the U.S. lost Iran as this huge power in the region, they had to rely on Israel a lot more. Israel just happened, got lucky, I guess, in a sense, but I'm just saying, yeah.
Well, I apologize. I didn't mean that this is what you have said.
Right.
But there are, I know a good number of Iranians have implied this, and I wanted to just debunk that theory.
I see.
Regarding your second question, Iran's relationship with Lebanese Shiites. As I said earlier in our conversation, Shia Islam, which for many people is a Persianized version of Islam, became the state religion in Iran in 1501. The problem was that at that time, the Shiis were a small minority in Iran. The majority of Iranians were Sunni. And therefore, the Safavid dynasty, Shah Ismail specifically, had no choice but to go to southern Iraq and southern Lebanon to contact prominent Shi'i clerics to bring them to Iran for two purposes. Number one, to spread the teaching of Tu'abar Shi'ism, and number two, to provide legitimacy, religious legitimacy to the rule of the kings. And they did that. So the Iranians went to southern Lebanon, exactly the place where today is one of the strongholds of the Shiites, and part of it is also occupied by Israel. And there they contacted prominent clerics, and they brought him to Iran. And during the first 200 years, it is estimated somewhere between 30 to 60 prominent families moved to Iran, and they became a powerful figures in imperial court. They became powerful figures in spreading Shia Islam in Iran. That relationship continued for years because of intermarriage, because of all kinds of connection. Now, fast forward to early 1960s, late 1950s and 1960s. Mohammad Reza Shah is an American ally. He is in power. And at the same time, there is a new threat in the Middle East to his rule, and that threat came from pan-Arabism, espoused, right. Yes, yeah. Espoused by Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt, who, by the way, was an admirer of Mossadegh, and for that reason alone, the Shah didn't like
right,
him.
Right.
But Abdel Nasser was an incredibly charismatic leader, and he really posed a threat to the monarchies of the region and to pro-American forces. And in one of the areas where pro-Nasser forces were quite strong were in Iraq, Iran's neighbor, and the other one was in Lebanon, where there is also, as you know, a substantial Christian population and Sunni population. Well, Iran didn't have good relationship with Iraq, so there wasn't much Iran could do in Iraq. However, they could do quite a bit in Lebanon. And that's why, starting in the 1960s, a plan was devised by Savak that if we go ahead, if we can help Lebanese Shiites to mobilize them and to institutionalize their support for us, that Shia force can become a counterforce against Nasserism or pan-Arabism in the region. And that's why the Shah decided to make Lebanon, Beirut specifically, the headquarters of Iranian intelligence operation in the entire Middle East. Now, in the late 1950s and early 60s, a young Iranian cleric by the name of Musa Sadr, S-A-D-R, was invited to go to Lebanon to become the leader of Lebanese Shias. At that time, the Shias were the least powerful minority in Lebanon. Lebanon was established as an independent state, of course, by France, and they set up the system in a way that the Christian minority always had the control of the armed forces and the presidency, and the Sunnis had the control of the office of prime minister. And the least important position, the speaker of Lebanese parliament, was given to the Shias. But when you look at those three groups in the 1960s, the Shias were the least powerful of them. Mm-hmm. And Musa Sadr's task was to empower Shias, and in my judgment, he weaponized that Shia grievances in Lebanon and turned them into a powerful force. In fact, by 1975, as Lebanon was plunging into a devastating civil war, Imam Musa Sadr, who was a cleric, a very charismatic cleric, an open-minded cleric, was able to establish the organization called Amal, which today is one of the two most powerful Shia organizations.
Nabi Berri, right?
That is Nabi Berri, absolutely. Yeah. Now, what a lot of people don't understand is that in the 1960s and 70s, Lebanon and to some degree Syria, became the new a haven for Iranian dissidents, especially Islamist opponents of the Shah's regime. Mousasat had asked the support of an Iranian American by the name of Mr. Chamran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, PhD, interesting character. Yes.
Yes. Who was in Berkeley?
Right.
Who lived in Berkeley, California? Had a PhD from a very good university, and was working in a major American company. He decided to leave in mid 1960s. Went to Iraq. Went to Lebanon, and established a network for Iranian dissidents who wanted to be trained in guerrilla activities. The organization Amal was more or less established by Mr. Chamran, who was sort of a spiritual son of Mousasat. So together, they created this network of dissidents who would go to Lebanon and then to Syria to get training. For your information, many of the top leaders of Iran, including a former head of Iranian IRGC, or the Revolutionary right. Guard, was trained in Lebanon.
Right.
Chamran himself became defense minister in the new government after the overthrow of the Shah's regime. At any rate, so the relationship was very strong during the Shah's days. Now, there is no question that Imam Mousasat had connection to the imperial government. Mm-hmm. He had met with the Shah at least twice that we know. He got some financial support from the Shah, although how much, we don't know. But he was a supporter of the monarchy, and there is no evidence that he personally opposed the Shah. At any rate, right around the time of the Islamic Revolution, after he wrote a very important letter to the editor of the Le Monde magazine, Le Monde newspaper in France, supporting Ayatollah Khomeini, he visited Libya at the invitation of Muammar Gaddafi, and we do not know what happened to him after his visit. He disappeared. As far as I know, he was killed. Who killed him? I don't know. There are different theories. I don't want to discuss those, but he was killed. But he left a powerful legacy. By 1979, before the revolution happened in Iran, Lebanese Shiites had become a formidable force in Lebanon already. Then came the Islamic Revolution, and Ayatollah Khomeini, around the time that Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in September of 1980, a group of Lebanese Shiites, including Hassan Nasrullah, who was recently killed by the Israelis, they traveled to Iran, and they got an audience with Ayatollah Khomeini, and Ayatollah Khomeini approved the creation of what eventually became Hezbollah in Lebanon. For a while, the top leadership and the main decision makers of Hezbollah were Iranians, although the rank and file were predominantly Lebanese. But Hezbollah gained notoriety when they attacked the American barrack, Marine barrack in Lebanon, and the French, and in a terrorist operation killed several hundred American and French officers. And it is from that moment on that Hezbollah became ever closer to Iran. And over the next 3 decades, I would say it became the crown jewel member of the axis of resistance that General Qasem Soleimani had established at the turn of the new century.
Okay, we will end part one of our interview with Mohsen Milani on Iran's rise and rivalry with the United States here. And John, did you want to say something?
What struck me about Mohsen's comments was I remember very strongly that Hezbollah was indeed the crown jewel in the axis of resistance after the 2006 war. And the Houthi were marginal. I mean, they were marginal in the Arab world. They were far away in North Yemen, more or less landlocked, especially after their only port had been bombed for the 20th time. But in the wake of the latest war, Hezbollah was sort of stymied, and I'm still not entirely clear how, but they were. And the Houthi, even though they've been raided and bombed pretty ruthlessly, proved a little more difficult to squelch.
Well, that's a good way to set up a cliffhanger for part two of our interview with Mohsen, because we will be discussing Iran's relationship with the Houthis and what is sort of the current and near future state of the axis of resistance and Iran, and how is Iran going to deal with the fact that it lost its crown in the jewel, Hezbollah, at least for now, as, you know, as a forward fighting force.
Right.
So yeah, we'll end the episode here. And then the next part two of the interview we'll post like tomorrow. We'll get the answers to that. So thanks again, everyone. Thanks, John.
Thanks,
and thank you to Mohsen. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.